Switzerland is celebrating a rather awkward anniversary this year. 50 years ago, women got the right to vote at the federal level. That's right, just 50 years ago. That's decades after German, Russian, American, British, French, Chinese, Indian, Mexican. Well, it's decades after most of the world's women got the vote. What was the holdup in Switzerland? And what's still holding women back today? Why is gender equality so hard to achieve? We'll try to get some answers here on The Swiss Connection, a Swiss Info production. I'm your host, Susan Masika, and I got some good mail the other day. It was a fat envelope for the next voting day. There's literature outlining the pros and cons of a yes or no vote, plus the full text of the proposed legislation. Like I said, it's a fat envelope. This time we'll be voting on 3 national matters and 5 local ones. I like the process, even if I'm not always sure what the best answer is. And casting the ballot, whether by mail or in person, is always very satisfying. My experience is such a contrast to the generations of Swiss women before me. By the 1960s, after a century of campaigning, only some of the more progressive regions were allowing women to have a say on local issues, but women in Switzerland didn't get the right to vote on national issues until 1971.
On se souviendra de la date de ce 7 février en Suisse, date historique en effet, puisque les femmes ont dès aujourd'hui conquis son droit de vote et d'éligibilité sur le plan fédéral.
That was news footage from the day of the yes vote. Now, it's the 50th anniversary that's making headlines and making people take stock of how things are going today.
50 years of women's suffrage in Switzerland is a great time to celebrate, but it's also a great time to think about what went wrong the last 50, the last 100, the last 200 years.
That's Regula Stampfli, a Swiss political scientist and co-host of Die Podcasten, a German-language feminist podcast. She left Switzerland when she was a teenager in the 1970s.
It's still quite usual to disregard women in a way you would never do in Britain. I mean, you know, that's why I left Switzerland. I left Switzerland when I was 16. I went to the States for a year and then I always went back. States or Great Britain. And now I'm living in Munich and Vienna, but I lived in Brussels for 20 years because I could not have a career in Switzerland as I did outside because of women's issues.
Well, it's Switzerland's loss.
Thank you. We'll see.
She was telling me that part of the reason Switzerland lagged behind on women's suffrage is because the decision was left to the male voters. Some people emphasize the fact that Switzerland is the only country where the majority of men, 66%, actually did say yes to women's suffrage, whereas in other countries, it was the lawmakers who decided.
I mean, that narrative, that storytelling does have some kind of truth, but it actually does ignore the violence against women, which was absolutely normal for hundreds of years, and especially during the First and Second World War and in the after-war period in Europe for Swiss women, because not having the suffrage meant for Swiss women not to be able to study, to choose their own profession, to have their own bank account, to hand over their family name to the children, to hand over the citizenship to the children, even to keep their own citizenship. So actually, not having the suffrage. And I think most people ignore that. They just think, oh, yeah, you know, women's suffrage, that's an old piece of cake. But not having the suffrage meant for women really being stuck in a halfway slave status. And I think that kind of violence is only is only recognized 50 years afterwards.
And for some Swiss women, it's been only 30 years since they could enjoy full voting rights. In the eastern part of Switzerland, there's a rural canton called Appenzell Innerrhoden. The men there didn't want the women to vote on local issues. They didn't want them to vote at all. But finally, in 1990, the federal Supreme Court ordered the regional authorities to uphold federal law and let the women vote. Surprised? You're not the only one. A few weeks ago, I was chatting with a Swiss guy in his 20s. He was shocked when I mentioned this. I asked Regula what she thought about his reaction.
It is a problem because the young generation, as all young generations, they think they have it all. They know it all, they have it all, and they're much better than their parents' generation or grandparents' generation. You know, it's this feeling, this wonderful feeling of youthfulness starting anew. It is a problem for women in Switzerland in general and for women all over Europe, this not knowing the history of democratic struggle of women. And why is it a problem? Because every generation then repeats the same visibility issues, the same not listening to women, the same patterns of blocking women, especially, you know, clever women, talented women, composers, artists, poets, sportswomen, etc., etc. I mean, the void in history concerning women's achievements is flabbergasting.
Speaking of the younger generation, Regula was telling me that her activism was intense until about 2010, when she decided to take a back seat to younger feminists. But then the coronavirus crisis came. She saw how women were typically the first to lose their jobs and also the first to take charge of pandemic childcare and homeschooling. The unfairness and the gender stereotypes inspired her to launch a new project.
So I came back and I started a podcast with another academic, Isabel Rohner, fantastic, and it's been nominated for the 5 best podcasts in the German-speaking world. But what we've come to realize is how much has been neglected, forgotten again in 2021. I was studying and political activist in the 80s and the 90s very strongly, and the first women's strike, I put it into the Swiss unions as an idea, and it was very successful. We had even at one time a majority of women in the Swiss government. And then the following 10 to 20 years, it's all been a backlash. It's been gone. I mean, that's what American women also realized with the election of Trump 2016. If the women's movement had not been dismantled all the time, or, you know, being fragmented, like it has the last 200 years, Donald Trump would have never been elected.
But according to Regula, the backlash isn't just coming from right-wing conservatives. She also sees it coming from the left, even from people you might expect to have more of an affinity for women's issues.
You see it with the queer movement and the trans movement, which calls itself feminist and the real feminism. You see very often their activism is aimed against women. So it's actually a classic of the last 200 years, you know, to make women invisible. Now the intellectual argument is that there is no such thing as women, as, you know, feminists always try to say. But of course they meant, you know, the social role. But now there's a strong movement of actually just denying women any voice at all. And it's hidden behind the veil of progressivism. And that I find very troubling, but very fascinating. How did we get there?
and how do we get out? I mean, what is the way out?
How do we get out? Then that's easier. I'm a strong believer in the rule of law. And we have seen that the suffrage was extremely important for changing all the laws in the last 50 years. We're not quite there yet, but the Swiss women have achieved a tremendous amount in civil law, in politics, good numbers in politics, in the commissions, in the academia. They have to really push hard now. And I believe in the rule of law in the sense of if we introduce quota, which there is not a majority yet, but we'll get there for diverse people and women. If we have a quota, because Switzerland is the country of quotas with languages, different regions, federalism, etc. If we get that, we'll be in a good place. So I hope that the power that we got through analyzing the 50 years jubilee, that we take that power and put forward the quota, which is actually in some parties, it's already totally natural. And even in the government, there is a sensibility of, not just a sensibility, but there is also a good quota for women as experts, for spending public money on women and not just on men. I mean, there is another number, the huge public money in culture also goes to 75% to men. It's incredible. Nobody would have thought that. And money is not nothing. Money is incredibly important. And so I think to get out of the rut that women have been in the last at least 100 and 150 years is also to finally redistribute the finances for women. That means, you know, at all level, public spent money has to obey the quota for diverse and women. Otherwise, it's the elite paying each other off.
Have you got any predictions then for the 100th anniversary?
Ah, very nice. I don't have predictions, but I certainly have a vision. And that is that all human beings are created equal before not just the law, but culture. And that we're in a direct democracy where we can dance and laugh a lot and have the freedom to be free, which means that we have the means to express ourselves politically, no matter what race, what gender, what looks, what biology, what background we have. And I'm certain we'll get there. I think we'll have a few more strict and strong fights, unfortunately. But the trend, I think, is set in 2021. We're in a better situation than we've been before. Let's hope so.
That was historian and political scientist Regula Stampfli. If you understand German, you can hear more from her on March 4th, when Swiss Info hosts a digital panel discussion. It's called 50 Years of Women's Suffrage, Old Question of Power, New Struggle with New Minds.
The fat sizzled in the pan. Franny transferred the grated potato to the pan and grabbed a cloth to wipe the table. She cleared the potato peels into the scraps bucket. Though the days were getting ever so slightly longer, dawn was still more than an hour off, and the black night still pressed against the steamed-up windows. How many winter mornings had she spent in here, baking, cleaning, pot-walloping? Thousands. At the farm, one week blurred into the next, as nature crawled predictably from season to season. Always so much to do. Sunrises and sunsets to beat the band. Very pretty and everything, but she felt like she had seen all the variations. Later today, she would be walking on a footpath and waiting for traffic to pass before crossing the street between houses so tall you could not see their roofs. The relief of seeing so many different faces and being sure not to recognize a single one. People wearing well-cut clothes, and Margaret and she walking along happily through the crowd.
That's a passage from Voting Day, a new historical novella set in and around the Swiss capital, Bern. It takes place on a cold, damp Sunday in February 1959, a national referendum day, the day when Swiss men rejected women's right to vote. It tells the story of four women going about their business on that day, from before dawn until after bedtime. There are four main characters: a farmer's wife, the one whose mourning you just heard about, and also an office girl, a cleaning lady, and an executive who's been campaigning for women's suffrage.
There's a little bit of me in all of the characters at different stages of my life, you know, because we all have times where we're the victim and we all have times where we're the doer.
That's Irish author and Swiss Info contributor Claire O'Dea, who lives in Fribourg on the border of French and German-speaking Switzerland. She's been telling me about the characters in her book, which came out in February.
Obviously, I'm a million miles away from the farmer's wife character. Like, I'm a professional and have a, you know, slightly more, obviously more urban lifestyle and so on. But I'm the same age, you know, almost 50 as that character. And one major thing I can identify with her is the double burden, the domestic burden. If you're many, many women end up being more responsible for the running of the home on top of their professional activity within relationships. Yeah, for example, in the case of Franny, the first character, the farmer's wife, she is very downtrodden in a sense, and she's very much overloaded with domestic duties. And when she goes away, she knows she's going to be away in hospital for 2 weeks. She has to plan all the meals for her family while she's gone, and she has to arrange somebody to take over from her. And, you know, I think you might be surprised how many mothers would go to extraordinary lengths to cover their absence because they feel such a sense of responsibility for keeping the home running, you know, and you know, a disproportionate sense of responsibility, to be honest.
I can remember not that long ago, I don't know, 10 years ago, talking to a young woman who didn't know how to do her laundry. Her mother had always done it, and she was about to move into her own apartment, and she was nervous about doing the laundry. And I couldn't believe it.
That's just terrible. I mean, that's very common. I mean, generally you hear it more about young men whose mothers have been doing their laundry, but I'm so determined. I have three daughters, and for me, you know, by the age of 10, they should be doing their own wash. They should know when the basket is full, and they should know how to work the machine. I mean, you know, a dog could turn on the washing machine. It's not complicated. And then know that, you know, the clothes don't just magically reappear in their bedroom. You know, I think that's a mistake on behalf of mothers. But, you know, the more that the mothering and domestic role is built up and sort of cordoned off as women's work, the more women maybe try to, I don't know, compensate or just, you know, excel in that role and do too much. Again, we're going back to conditioning. You know, it's like, why do women take their husband's name, which incidentally, I didn't have a choice when I got married in Switzerland. The law was made it so that I had to take my husband's name. But now you can do what you like, and you still have the majority of women who take their husband's name and basically cease to exist legally. You know, the old person is gone. My phone is ringing now. Can you hear that?
Okay.
I'll call them back. You know, 90% of the phone calls I get are marketing calls.
Yeah, I think if you answer them, then they say, oh, great, there's someone home. And now there's so many people home these days.
Yeah, exactly. We're a captive audience.
Yeah. And can you tell us about the other characters in the book? You've got four, actually, main characters, haven't you?
So the first character is the middle-aged farmer's wife. So that's Franny, and she is due to have an operation the next day, and which is sort of like a treat for her because it's a break out of the routine and she'll get some rest. And then there's her daughter is the next character, Margaret, who's 23, and she's kind of like the young, hoping for a career girl starting out in the working world. And, you know, in a way, she feels like the world is her oyster, but when it comes down to it, she's facing a lot of obstacles and she can only earn so much and she's not necessarily safe in her workplace. So that's her. And then the third character is the young Yenish, a mother whose child has been taken away from her and she's got no education and she's working as a cleaning woman. And then the final character is actually the only one of the four who's engaged with the campaign for the women's vote. The others, like, it's just hardly on their radar. They might see the odd poster or they hear the men talking about it. And so Beatrice, the final character, she's older. She's more from an established bourgeois family. And she's political. She's a political animal, and you know, a little bit pompous, a little bit. They all have their blind spots, you know. So Beatrice does too. But the way they all come together, they're connected by the fate of a foster child. You know, if there's a message in the book, it's about pulling together and how women and anyone really can, through solidarity, help each other to have a better life.
As we wait at a junction, I notice a yes poster I haven't seen before. It shows a smiling man casting his yes vote. He has a lipstick kiss on his cheek. One way of getting their attention, I suppose. I'm not one for politics, but this vote feels like an important test. Either we are in this together, men and women, or we are not. For the first time ever, I wonder how long I can do this. There are jobs in Bern, but the pay is so low. Maybe it would be different if I had a nice little apartment with my own bath and kitchen. How long can you live alone in one room? It seems like the solution for a better life is to find a man. I don't think I'm against marriage. I just don't know if the right kind of man exists for me.
I like how at the back of your book, you've printed some of the old political posters. How did you select those?
Yeah, those posters are just, I mean, you have to see them. You know, I mean, they're findable online. They are an amazing testament to the culture of the time. And the no posters and the yes posters, they're equally interesting. And the ones I chose, you know, we have some really nice, colorful and visually interesting posters. You know, there's one with actually it's not even from 1959. It's from a later campaign at cantonal level. There's a woman with her hand, holding her hand up in front of to the camera, kind of, you know, slightly glamorous young woman. And it's kind of like, stop, leave us out of the game.
You know, oh, yes.
Don't bother us with these political hassles. You know, we just want to live a quiet life. You know, that message. Yeah.
That one stuck out to me too, especially because it was more recent. It seemed, hard to believe somebody would agree to pose for that.
Yeah. Well, even when the vote was when women got the vote in 1971, it was by a 2/3 majority. That's still a very substantial amount of voters, male voters, a third of the men who didn't want to change, and there could easily have been as many women who felt the same, who were sort of, you know, well, they had accepted their role and they were conditioned to accept this division between the men's world and the women's world. And, you know, if you don't fight against it, you know, you'll have an easier life. Like, that's what Beatrice, the character, says. She almost wishes she'd never seen this fundamental unfairness all around her. You know, it started at a certain point and then she just couldn't stop seeing it. And she was kind of like tormented by it.
Well, I'm no Iris von Roten, but I have my ideas. There's all the domestic stuff, the way women are brought up to practically run a hotel for their men and consider that the height of achievement. But it's the invisibility of women that bothers me the most. Look in the newspapers, listen to the radio, the museums, the galleries, the shop signs, the Bundeshaus, for goodness sake. I'd almost prefer if I had never noticed and never cared, because my outrage has no effect. I would have saved myself a lot of bitterness.
And this takes place long before you lived in Switzerland. How did you come up with the characters and the feeling of those times?
Over the years, I've lived in Switzerland, as you say, not that long. It's 18 years. And I have a large extended family of in-laws, and it's something that has come up again and again. I just ask people about how they, well, maybe I'm more curious about women, you know, how they got on, what did they do when they left school? A lot of people in the area where I live, it's kind of close to the rural part of Freiburg. A lot of people were kind of in service in one way or another, domestic service, helping out with other families or other farms. That kind of thing was done a lot on an informal level. And so that was just like my personal connections and hearing from people over the years. But then also through my work as a journalist, I interviewed a lot of people who had been through various injustices to do with the system, the care system or the legal system. And so that was a way of understanding something, a time that's you know, relatively recent and yet, you know, quite extreme in terms of the things that happened. So, you know, there was a lot of good material there.
And how strong did you find that the memories of these people were that you've been talking to, whether they're relatives or people you've interviewed? How strong do the feelings seem to come up when you ask about this time?
Very much, very strong. You know, when you're talking about formative years, people tend to have clearer memories of their youth and certain stages of their youth, maybe, than if you ask them, you know, how exactly did you feel when you were 35 or 45? That might be, it all gets a bit vague in midlife, let's say. I think people still have very strong feelings, especially if they were ill-treated. And, you know, for example, I remember interviewing a man who wrote a memoir, and he had been taken away from his mother as a baby, because she was a deserted wife. Also, because she was Yenish, she was from an ethnic minority of traveling people, and he grew up in a home. And like, to say that he was marked by those years is really putting it mildly. Although he went on to have a good life, I think he was more in the minority. People who managed to overcome all of that suffering.
Could you imagine? Anyway, let's go back in time. I mean, when did you come here?
2003.
Do you think you would have come here from Ireland back in the 60s or the 70s?
Well, now you're asking about Ireland is no paragon of treating women well. I think that at least one thing in Switzerland, even though there was this arch conservatism, which basically punished people who did moral transgressions, like getting pregnant outside marriage. But the church didn't have the same power here as it would have in Ireland. And despite not having the vote, and Irish women have had the vote since 1922, I think I would have been better off as a woman in Switzerland in the 1960s than in Ireland.
80s? Would you have come here in the 80s or the 90s?
I'm sorry, but there are things that happen in Ireland in the 1980s that, especially for women, that are just so extraordinarily grim that literally any other country, I mean, in the Western world, would have been better. I'm sorry to say that, but people's minds were imprisoned by the church. In Ireland, it reminds me a little bit of communism, those regimes, totalitarian regimes. There was just so much control over people's lives. Like, I think of it as a very grey, very bleak time. Having said that, Ireland has been transformed since then, let's say from the 1990s on. And now I think it's a fantastic place to live. And, you know, it's going in a really healthy direction. And I think we've corrected a lot of those issues.
And for women in Switzerland, getting the vote 50 years ago was also a big step. Thanks for joining us, Claire, and for your literary snapshot of the day the men said no.
Thank you, Susan. I really welcome the opportunity. I think it's important that we pause and reflect on this 50th anniversary. There's a lot to learn and a lot to understand.
That was author Claire O'Dea, giving me the backstory on her new novel, Voting Day. The book is available in 4 languages, English, German, French, and Italian, from Bergley Books in Basel, which ships internationally. For more on the women's movement and fight for suffrage in Switzerland, visit us at swissinfo.ch for all sorts of articles, videos, and galleries. Have you been enjoying this podcast? We produce a new episode every 2 weeks. Go ahead and subscribe so you don't miss the next one. And don't forget to tell your friends, too. This episode was reported and produced by me, Susan Masika. Our sound engineer, responsible for mixing the audio, is Donnie Wheeler. And the theme music you're hearing now is by Michele Andina. Thanks for listening to The Swiss Connection.
Hi, my name is Fabio Canich. I'm the host of another Swissinfo podcast, The Geldcast. I'm a journalist and lecturer on international monetary policies. In my podcast, I talk to finance experts, politicians, and people in the banking industries on money-related topics. This podcast is from the land of money, Switzerland. It is published bi-weekly on YouTube. Highly valuable content, but free to listen to.